This episode of the American Birding Podcast is brought to you by HX Expeditions, offering mindful adventures to curious travelers since 1896. An HX Expedition cruise is the best way to see some of the world's rarest birds, like McKay's bunting. With onboard science centers, ornithologists, photographers, and a range of outdoor activities, an HX Expedition is a birder's paradise. Change the way you see the world. Book now and find out why birders are raving about HX. Hello and welcome to the American Birding Podcast from the American Birding Association. I am your host, Nate Swick. You probably felt a disturbance in the birding force this week, the result of a rare bird phenomenon crossing over onto traditional news. For the first time since last summer's flamingo apocalypse, we have rare birds in the news and the associated public bewilderment. But don't take it from me. Let me throw it over to, in order, Fox 5 News Vegas, ABC News Now Las Vegas, and somewhat surprisingly, Hawaii News Now.
Breaking news just minutes ago, we have learned that the Bellagio Fountain is going to pause all shows for tonight. This all deals with the presence of a rare bird, the yellow-billed loon, that has been stuck at the fountain for some time. So what we heard from MGM is that the Nevada Department of Wildlife had gone to the fountain earlier this afternoon. The Bellagio had paused the fountains for some time while Endow was at the scene. Now, Endow, about an hour ago, told the Bellagio they could proceed, but we just got a call from an MGM spokesperson that all shows are halted for this evening. We're working to learn more information and how state wildlife officials are going to proceed with this bird rescue. The yellow-billed loon is one of the 10 rarest birds in the U.S. We will bring you more updates right here on Fox 5 News, and we'll be back after the break.
New and trending tonight, a rare guest has checked into the Bellagio, canceling tonight's fountain show, but it's not who you would expect. The resort confirming on social media that a rare bird called a yellow-billed loon is enjoying some pool time in Lake Bellagio. We spotted him getting some exercise. Resort officials say they are working with state wildlife officials to rescue it. The fountain shows will resume after that.
719 and what's trending?
If you've ever been to Vegas, you know all about that famed fountain show at the Bellagio.
Oh, so many movies.
Yeah, I know. Well, the fountains had to be shut down as a result of an unexpected and rare guest.
Oh, no.
The hotel and casino announced on social media Tuesday they had to shut down the fountain.
Yes.
And get this, there's a bird called a yellow-billed loon. It was spotted in the lake. They're considered to be one of the rarest birds in the country. Biologists were able to capture the loon yesterday, located to a more suitable location.
It just looks like a regular duck.
Well, you do see the yellow at the tip.
But how anyone was able to identify this bird is kind of beyond me.
Yeah, kind of loony, huh?
I always think Ocean's 11 when I see that. Yes.
A lot to unpack here, for starters. A regular duck, ma'am. Someone needs to head over to our YouTube channel and watch Greg Neese and I on our bi-weekly What's This Bird live show, because we talk loons versus grebes versus ducks regularly. And second, sir, I'm the one who makes the lazy puns around here, okay? As you gathered, a young yellow-billed loon, likely disoriented by heavy winds, mistook the fountains in front of the glitzy Bellagio Hotel and Casino on the Las Vegas Strip for a real lake and put down for several days after having been seen at the nearby Henderson Bird Preserve. Yellow-billed loon, always a nice bird to see in the lower 48, particularly inland, though I'm not sure where the claim that it is one of the 10 rarest birds in the United States came from, except that the Bellagio posted that on their social accounts. No matter, the bird was captured by the State Wildlife Agency and relocated to a more appropriate location. The best possible outcome, I think. But I can't get over the interest with the name loon. Perhaps we are fortunate that a vagrant bush tit or titmouse did not get trapped in any sort of Las Vegas casino. Is this enough to endorse an official US-UK Gavia alignment at long last? Would long-tailed duck presage divers on both sides of the Atlantic? Afterwards, maybe we can decide whether the bill of the bird is yellow or white, because apparently we can't decide that either. It's sort of both. If any bird deserves the ivory-billed moniker, it's probably this one. We've certainly been seeing better bird literacy in media these days. I credit the general increased interest in birds and nature for that, but some things, like goofy bird names, we cannot overcome. It will always be my minor vexation when I hear it, my loony tick, if you will. That's how you do it. Hawaii News Now. On the show this week, Bird Festival stalwart, Koa Optics rep, and digiscoping evangelist Jeff Boughton joins us to talk about his digiscoping big year record. Want to beat it? He's pretty sure you can. All after this week's Rare Birds. This is your Rare Bird Focus for the first third of March 2024. We are still deep in the rare bird doldrums with no noteworthy new birds seen in the ABA area this week. But remarkably enough, this first quarter of the year has been excellent for rarity retention. Many of the birds that we have talked about over the last few months are still present, which is as remarkable as any new bird, if you ask me. In South Texas, a birder can still see the ABA's third bare-throated tiger heron, multiple roadside hawks, the third model owl, second crane hawk, and third gray-collared bacard, along with a fan-tailed warbler, a flock of brown jays, and too many golden-crowned warblers, crimson-collared grosbeaks, and blue buntings to keep track of anymore. And in addition, the cattle tyrant is still being seen in downtown Corpus Christi up the coast. Birders in New Jersey are still seeing the red-flanked blue tail first reported back in early December of last year, and Wisconsin's first field fare is still being seen, as are the pair of whooperswans in Washington. While most all of the American flamingos that were part of the massive post-hurricane influx this past year have moved on, there are still birds being seen regularly in Florida and, as of a month ago, in South Carolina as well. So more of an update than a focus this time around, but you can keep up with the rare bird scene at aba.org/RBA on Fridays and in our ABA Rare Bird Alert group on Facebook and on ABA Community for the rest of the week. Digiscoping is one of the newer ways people enjoy birds, so it's no surprise, perhaps, that bird records involving this practice are few and far between. Someone needed to come along and lay down the gauntlet, and last year, that person was Jeff Boughton. Many birders know Jeff as the representative for Koa Optics. He's a familiar face around bird festivals and events, and now the digiscoping big year champion. I think that's the title that we're going with, a record set in 2023. He's here to challenge others to match him. Jeff, welcome. Is 2024 off to a big digiscoping start, or are you laying lower this year?
It's definitely lower. You know, last year was a bit of a unique travel year for me, and then I got a lot of surprise international trips that I got invited on, which changed the game. You know, through the job, as you know, I mean, going to these birding events, you just see a lot of birds when, you know, even on the domestic stuff. But
yeah, kind of passively. Yeah.
Yeah. You can't help but, you know, you're going to these places that are, you know, at the peak time to be there generally is when these things are scheduled, and you just wind up running into a lot of birds, which is a happy, happy thing.
Yeah. For people who may not be familiar with digiscoping, with the process of digiscoping, can you explain how it works and why you enjoy it more than regular photography?
Well, yeah. I mean, for me, it's you got to go back a ways and understand that my trigger, my spark moment in birding was a view of a snowy owl through a spotting scope as I was walking home from high school, you know, and I'd never looked through optics before. You know, and just so from day one, my birding career has kind of revolved around a spotting scope and, you know, that extra detail that you can appreciate. So I've always been a fan. And it seemed like throughout my career as a, you know, budding, you know, binoculars for hire, I always had it over shoulder, whether I was doing field research or guiding professionally. And actually, even before digiscoping was a thing, I learned from some of my friends in the UK that would come over to Cape May when I was doing the hawk watch there. And they were describing how twitchers on the Scilly Isles were using these disposable film cameras behind the spotting scope.
I had no idea.
Way back. And so, you know, sure enough, I grabbed one of those disposable Kodak cameras, you know, a little cardboard one that you get at the, at the checkout there. Impulse buy, and I always had one of those in my pack, you know, so I'd done a little bit of that. So I mean, that was the the Renaissance, I guess, and then, you know, work my way into being an optics rep, which I've done. Gosh, I hate to do the math like this, but this will be my 20th year.
As long as I have been involved in birds and birding and like with the AVA coming to events and stuff, you have always been there. So,
yeah,
and I mean, it's only been about a decade for me. So it's been much longer.
So this is year 20. So, I mean, I've kind of been there throughout, you know, as an early pioneer, early adapter, and watched all the changes. So that's the backstory. But I mean, digiscoping itself, for those that don't know, is, you know, just kind of an amalgamation of two words. It's placing some form of digital photography device behind a spotting scope, ergo digiscoping. And the big advantage is, of course, the massive magnification and the huge reach and focal lengths that you get that are unmatched anywhere else in photography. You know, generally speaking, just using my phone behind my spotting scope, I'm shooting anywhere from about 1,000 millimeters up to over 5,000 millimeter lens
equivalents. Yeah,
which, you know, comes with a huge variety of their own problems. You know, stability becomes so much more crucial when you're dealing with these massive focal lengths. And then the other problem is, you know, because you can reach out and touch a subject so much further, you know, there's a lot of atmospheric stuff that comes into play as well that is problematic, hard to deal with. So. Yeah, there's that, but it's just me. And as a, you know, an avid birder who's always wanted to have that spotting scope, you know, it's like my third arm kind of, I'm not interested in carrying a camera around. So it just kind of developed, you know, it wasn't because the job demanded it so much as it was truly a passion from the beginning. So
I guess I'm still kind of, my mind is still kind of blown about the idea of taking those disposable cameras and using those through a spotting scope. What kind of quality did that get? And I actually kind of want to go try that if I can find those disposable cameras. Right. You can sell those anymore now that everyone has a cell phone.
Not great. It was always vignetted. Of course, there was no such thing as zooming out. We didn't know what we were doing. There were no wide angle zooms back then. You know, so stuff's, you know, and to a degree, you're kind of shooting blind. I'm trying to remember. I don't think those things shoot through the lens, you know?
Yeah.
So, as I recall, you're just kind of hoping and poking. And because you had to wait weeks, you know, before you saw what your results were, it was, you know, it was hard to remember what you did wrong or, you know, so the thought of, you know, varying the distance between the eyepiece and in the camera, never thought of, you know, things
right. You just kind of cram it up there and just, you know, hope you get something.
Somewhere I've got you know, heavily digiscoped images of a pair of redneck stents copulating in Barrow and a Temming stent that I found up there that was saying, you know, that I documented. So it works, you know, and it was back in those days there was no digital photography at all, and so film was it, and film photography was difficult. I mean, you know, image stabilization and things of that nature weren't there, you know, so it was any type of photography was a challenge back then, and you just didn't know what you got till you got your results back, like I said.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible, even in the last 10 years, like how far digiscoping has come. I mean, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, cell phones, like high quality cameras on cell phones weren't really a thing. So people were taking their DSLRs, and there are all sorts of fancy adapters that you could hook up. And now, you know, your phone is as good as half of those things, certainly as good as a point and shoot.
Yep.
And it's, digiscoping is so accessible now, you know, more than ever, for sure.
Agreed. And the quality, like you said, is so much better. And it's, it seems counterintuitive, but in a lot of ways, the small lens and the sensors of the phones often seem to do as well or better than cameras, you know, that are far more expensive and far more, what I want to say.
There's a higher barrier for use. Like they're not as easy. Yeah.
Yeah. But they can be more complex and more difficult to get good pictures with than the phones at times. So, it's really come full circle, and it's gotten a lot of fun, now for, I think, folks, because you can realistically get a lot more keeper images than you ever used to be able to get, you know,
for sure. So what is your digiscoping process?
Well, I'm a hack at best. I do not consider myself a photographer. I'm a birder, and I shoot from the hip. I don't set up. I don't usually sit in blinds or anything like that. You know, I'm always on the move and just shooting from the hip as I go. So I'm probably like the worst person, you know, actually to talk about. But For me, I think the most important thing is speed.
Yeah.
You know, I'm practiced enough that if I see a bird, I can move from viewing to photography very quickly. And that, you know, led me to, you know, probably a couple hundred species that I wouldn't have had if I were a few seconds later, honestly. So that's the most important thing. But if you learn just a couple tricks, you know, on the phones, if you know how to use the auto lock and auto focus lock feature on phones, which most people don't realize you can do, and have that ability to just, you know, to find focus with the focus wheel on the scope once the focus is locked on the phone, and same with the exposure, being able to increase or decrease your exposure, having exposure compensation like that is a huge help for when, you know, you don't have the exposure that you want to have. You know, the metering doesn't quite work.
Oh, I remember when I was first introduced to digiscoping. I think it might have been with you when we went on that trip to Honduras with a bunch of folks. And you basically gave us some scopes and some phone scope adapters and said, go nuts.
Yeah.
And I remember the feeling of like getting what I felt were, you know, nature documentary quality videos of these birds that were flying around, especially hummingbirds that are coming to feeders, with very little practice. I'm even more of a hack photographer than you are, Jeff. And like, I was able to get stuff that I still have on my phone and show off to people. So yeah, it's incredible how easy it is and how accessible the whole thing is.
Yeah, it really is. It's a lot of fun. And I mean, you can do it with your binoculars as well, you know, which
that's
is even more accessible. But yeah, extremely hard for me, you know, the shake factor and the fact that you reduce, you know, an eight power binocular, you're, you know, more the equivalent of a 400 millimeter lens. So in that case, it's not really superior in any way to what you can do just swinging a 400 from the hip, you know.
Yeah. But, about your big year, did you start with sort of a record in mind, or was it something that you just sort of ended up falling into at some point?
Yeah, absolutely the latter. You know, I'm the guy who swore I'd never do a big year, you know, so even calling it a big year now, it's kind of,
what else are you going to call it?
Yeah. I mean, it was a big year, lowercase maybe, but certainly the effort was not a big year effort. You know, I mean, I was just shooting images of birds like I always do, in the course of what I do for work, you know. So I do, you know, a lot locally when I'm at home, of course, but outside of work trips, you know, and everything else was in my home county practically, you know, that was not a work trip.
Which is, by the way,
I'm in Charlotte County in Southwest Florida, you know,
good place for easy birds.
Absolutely. Yeah. We've got some, you know, very easy subject, shooting fish in a barrel with the wading birds and whatnot. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it was definitely not something I planned at all. You know, to put it into perspective, we always go out on 1-1, you know, around 4 a.m. January 1st and try and kick off the year list with a solid foundation, you know. And my buddy and I always do a century run in the county, usually be back home midday, you know, with 100 birds in the bag. And we did that last year, did 126 bird species that first morning, basically into the afternoon, of which I digiscoped 9, you know, so it was definitely not something that was ever a point of mine. And by the end of the first week, I remember I realized I had 101 bird species at the end of week one that I digiscoped only simply because they posed nicely. They were in nice light. And I just out of happenstance, you know, pull that out. And who knows? I mean, I've been doing this constantly. That's just a normal thing to do. But I never started keeping track of it until 2020. You know, when the world locked down, that's when I was like, I needed a new something else to occupy my time because I couldn't travel anymore for the first time in forever and just seemed kind of lost.
Yeah.
You know, being at home, you know, it's like, wow, now what? How's this work? And so long. It was really cool. Actually, for the first time, I got to enjoy migration in my yard, which I couldn't remember had been so long.
Yeah.
But I'm always elsewhere.
Was in Ohio or Texas or
I'm everywhere but there.
Yeah.
So that was neat, you know, but so that became a thing. I started counting digiscope birds and I remember, I don't know, it's all like that year we did have a little bit of travel before the world ended, you know, as it was, you know, we'd done the Whooping Crane in Port Aransas, you know, that festival, and went to San Diego Bird Festival, which obviously both of those would get you some different birds. And, you know, I think at the end of that year, I had like 300, even under lockdown, or 330, something like that. Mm-hmm. The following year, again, without trying to do anything special, travel started coming back, you know, very tentatively at first, you know, trial things towards the second, even third quarter, maybe of 21. Yeah. And at the very end, I got the opportunity to go to Costa Rica, you know, so, I mean, I had like 511 birds or 518 birds, I think, that year. I was like, wow, that's a lot. So 2023 started like any other year, you know, did home in January. And then, as you know, just talking about it, actually, we both got the opportunity to go down and be at the Columbia Bird Fair in Cali, Colombia. Right. Yep. You know, that was a quick 150 birds extra, you know, onto the list. And the other thing that had come up that we were able to put on the docket last year, which we've been wanting to do for years, was to create a digiscoping only team in the Champions of the Flyway.
I remember when you set that up. Yep.
You know, and so we finally did that at held in Eilat, Israel, you know, at the peak of their migration, fantastic migration corridor, you know, all the birds coming out of Africa, as you know, spreading across Eurasia. It's a spectacular
cool phenomenon. Yep.
Phenomenon, right? And, you know, did manage to tuck that in last year. But, you know, from a straight up birding standpoint, it was another, you know, 150 birds or whatever. So by the end of March, you know, I was already over 400 some odd species. I don't remember the exact number. And I was like, wow, this is going to be a big year. And I meant, you know, again, lowercase big year. I had personal, no intention personal. Because, you know, I mean, going to these events, I'm not, you know, taking special trips with the intent of photographing birds. I'm going.
A lot of times you have professional responsibilities at at the table.
You got a booth, you know, you got to man the table, you know, be there in the vending area through the vending hours. But, you know, you're at a really great birding location and you got birds you can't see at home. And I've always just gone out, you know, I mean, I'm going to go out that morning and you do the same. I know the ABA crew, when I see you guys, you're,
trying to fit it in.
The 3 hours we have before the booth opens.
Exactly.
Tucking in what we can. And I remember what changed for me was first when I went to the biggest week in American birding. And that, on that first day there, on the 4th of May, was the day that I actually cracked my own record. I was like, wow, I'm not barely 4 months in, a little over. And I'm already there. I wonder how big this could get. So that was a little bit of an eye opener and a game changer. And I did change my attitude a little bit. But still, you know, I'm not going places with the intent of seeing birds, but just as I can. And it just, it's a testament to how great these birding events are, I think. Where things got manic and stupid, you know, where it really got real though, was when I went to the Global Bird Fair in the UK. We went over there to introduce our new 66 millimeter spotting scope.
Yep.
And did have some extra travel tied in following that introduction, you know, because we're going to be showing it off in the US. So wanted to, you know, add some extra opportunities. But walking around the grounds there, all these international people that we know, friends from all around the globe, some of the, you know, the biggest tour leaders and everything. And people kept coming up and they say, hey, man, how's your big year going? What's the number? I'm like, you're aware of this silly thing I'm doing, you know, and that was like
an icebreaker for the birding world is if you're doing a big year, everyone's going to want to talk to you about it.
Right. You know, so it's like, I guess I got to start treating this more like a big year at this point. And so I came back kind of manic. And I remember, you know, the next shows were the Colorado field ornithologist, Western field ornithologist event. And again, I was like coming in 1 minute before vending and leaving 1 minute after it was done, and then people wouldn't see me again until after dark, you know. And then went from there to the back-to-back shows in Arizona with Southwest Wings Festival in Sierra Vista, followed by the Southeast Arizona Birding Festival, sponsored by Tucson Audubon there. And we got another 77 birds there. It was just, you know, getting up way pre-dawn to be at my spot, you know, at first light, finish up vending, you know, forego dinner, fire out, and coming back often far after dark, you know, because I'm looking for owls and poor whales and whatever else. That's where it got real, you know. And I remember people like Carlos Betancourt in particular.
Yeah.
Well, he kept asking me to go to dinner when I was in Arizona. I'm like, dude, I can't. Like three more hours of light. Three more hours of light.
Gotta get that whisker screenshot.
Yeah, I gotta go. Yeah, the whisker's out there. Yeah. That L file is calling my name. I finished up Arizona over 600. Mm-hmm. Had just a couple more events after that scheduled. Coming back home was pretty boring even by mid-May. I'd already gotten all the expected species. I'd seen most of the eastern migrants at that point. So those trips didn't offer much, and I'd get one or two or three. Went to Cape May, and one of the things that was kind of unfortunate last year, being kind of the La Nina year, there was a lot of rain. So in October, it rained every day. And then went to the Rio Grande Valley Festival, which was my last scheduled trip of the year. And again, every single morning it rained. Every single morning.
Yeah, I remember.
I was out there getting drenched, but, in both of those cases, I wound up getting like half of what I'd hoped I might get. So I came home after Rio Grande Valley. That was my last scheduled trip for the year. And, I was at 707 species, something like that. And I was like, oh, that's a good year. I could push it to 725 if I look around Florida, travel a bit more. And it was at that point that I got kind of another real surprise, fantastic opportunity. Our friend Herbert Bayaranga with Ugandan Safaris, Bird mm-hmm. Safaris, asked if I'd be interested in coming and speaking at the inaugural International Conference for Women Birders in Uganda. And I was like, what? Would you like me to come to Uganda? I could probably free my schedule up, so that was mid-December. And of course, got a ton of birds there, you're in the
tropics, different stuff,
you're in a whole different continent, So it was my first trip there, and you got like 238 species added, something like that. And it was 965, I think, that I was at that point. And I came back and said, that's it for travel, I'm done. And all these people now that were kind of following me on social
just
media.
Just shy of 1,000.
You can't. You got to do it. And I was honestly thinking, I'm like, where could I go? And I've been looking at the maps. It's like my only trip to the Pacific was for San Diego, and didn't do as well as could have there because of the weather. As a matter of fact, I didn't even go out a couple mornings because, again, I wasn't doing a big year or even considering going for a big number of digiscope. And so I said, I'm not going out, worked on the computer because it was raining. But even then, even though there were enough birds there, I would have to travel all over California. It would have been a pretty complicated mess. And it was that point that Carlos came back, and he'd commented a couple times. He said, dude, I've never seen you more driven than Arizona. He said, come on down here. Let's do this in Panama. So that was, he said, bring the boy, so my son and I did, we booked a flight, by now it's like mid-December. So the only window we had was after Christmas before New Year's, and went down there and, easily, with the best guide, arguably the best guide in the world. He's won that title a couple times.
Oh, for sure.
In his own backyard, at the Canopy family there. We stayed at the Canopy Tower, in Panama, over, one of the best patches of rainforest in the place. And, by noon the first morning, it was over. We added, I forget the total number of species. I'd have to do the math. What would that be like? Like 185, I guess.
Yeah.
Because we finished at 1,050.
Nice.
In Panama. And so four digits, arguably it was at close to 10% of the world's birds, depending on which taxonomy we're using. It's a bunch at any rate. But I didn't work really hard at it at all. I didn't put in a true big year effort.
Yeah.
So
just kind of fell into it. The first ones always are like that.
Yeah.
Whenever I think of digiscoping, I'm thinking of birds that are like slow moving, big, even if they're distant, relatively easy. Like at a certain point though, if you wanted to get to rack up some numbers, you had to focus on some of the little flitty things.
Yeah.
You have to try and go for everything. That must have been like, you must have known that you were serious once you started trying to digiscope warblers and sparrows and all the little things in addition to the bigger, flashier, easier birds.
That wasn't something that came out this year. Going on a quarter century of this style of photography, it's something I do anyways. That goes back to the speed.
Right. Because that stuff can be tough.
Yeah. Yeah, you literally have seconds and you need to make those count. One of the tricks that I do a lot there is I shoot in video mode. So if a bird is bouncing around in a tree, I'm kind of with it and I follow it until, you know, boom, it jumps out in the open. And I'll peel out a frame out of that, which works really well, except for, you know, when I peel that out and put it on eBird, the EXIF data doesn't match like the date and stuff. So it's
caused some, like that.
Some problems with that, you know, as far as looking at your year list. I thought that's how I was going to keep track of this and it didn't work because that EXIF data on a screenshot is not there and I can't.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, no, I didn't either. So that was a
lesson learned.
Manuelli, you know, on the, I made an Excel spreadsheet and in every day and just kind of flip through the phone. And if it wasn't there, I'd tack it on, you know, flipping through the photos.
Do you still have all your photos on your phone?
Not all. No. Again, at the beginning, especially because I didn't think I was going to do this. Unfortunately, there are some that no longer exist. They were that bad that I just had digiscoped them. So I don't think I can even prove all of them, unfortunately, especially the early ones.
Hey, you're trustworthy, Jeff.
From May forward, yeah. And the other thing, too, is my rules are, or were, because this is my game that I invented, right, you know, for myself, was I just had to shoot it through the COA scope, you know, well, COA binoculars, too. I counted the binoculars, so let's be honest, it's COA product, and I it had to be an identifiable image. And so I tried... It's time consuming, man. Oh God, I've been going back to try and rebuild as many of these as I can, you know, to have to make like a record, right? And I'm wondering if it might wind up being like 1,047 or 46 by the time I finish. There might be a couple. I'm like, you know,
not good enough. Yeah,
I might just let that one go. You know, you could argue. And again, identifiable. We look at, you know, what's this bird as an example, you know, and we get identify by whom becomes the question, right? You know, you can get a full frame perfect shot. If you don't have the experience, you know, you're not going to identify it compared to someone who's, you know, familiar with the birds and knows the birds that are there is going to. So there's some of those too, probably that, you know, we put in front of everybody be like, what? But my worst one, I think, that I tested while at the Champions, the flyway, was the what do you call it? The not white-tailed kite, the black-shouldered kite.
Oh right, yeah,
over there. You know, it was a picture, a fuzzy picture over this, you know, bird parachuting down, and you could make out the black holes on white, you know, and it was bad. It was really bad. and I showed it to a few people there, and they all got it right. I'm like, yeah, all right,
put good on enough. The yep, it'll work. So what was the most difficult bird to capture, or you know? Alternately, the most satisfying bird that you ended up getting a reasonable photo of?
Well, that's a good question. And I never really thought about it that way. I'm horrible at these questions. What's the best? Because I just love them all. You know, I really do.
That's right.
It's one of the things that I hated about this event. And one of the reasons I don't want to ever do one again, candidly, is towards the end, especially, I got
it becomes about the number. You know? Yep.
It's like, you don't matter. No, I need this.
I know. That's why I'm a bad big year birder. I hated it.
You know, it's like, I'm the guy like you too. You know, I mean, you're wired the same way. You know, you're walking down the street and you see a house sparrow doing something you've never seen before. Like, well, what is that? That's fascinating. You know? So it's just pure enjoyment. I don't have a good answer for that one, but I can tell you a little anecdote that's kind of funny. I remember, when I was at 999, you know, down there with Carlos on Pipeline Road, and this bird pops up. It's a new bird for the list, and I get in the scope, I train it in there, and I didn't take the shot because it was the dot winged ant wren. It's like, it's a little gray bird. It's got some white speckles. Anyway, it's not that great. And I walked away from it. And I felt like minutes after I'd done that, I go, what did I do? That's horrible. That dot-winged Aaron didn't deserve that, man. You know?
Yeah.
That was awful. I hated myself for that, you know? so it wound up the thousandth bird was a flashier white-tailed Trogon, you know?
Easier to digiscope too.
Well, true, but I had it dead to rights. I mean, I mean, literally all I do is push the button, but I'm like, nope, I don't want that to go down as number 1,000, you know? So I just took this snooty, you know, attitude towards the poor dot-winged ant wren. And I remember the next day I thought that I'd made it up to the dot wing ant wren. I Carlos had something great. He's calling me. He's, Jeff, come here. I'm like, hold on. I've got a dot winged ant. And I took the shot and ran down there. And later at lunch, I said, Carlos, I got bad news. He's like, whoa, what's that? I said, my dot winged ant wren had white flanks. So wound up being a white flanked ant wren. And I still never made it up to the dot winged ant wren.
Put him on the way.
I should be better than that.
What was the most impressive bird that you were able to add to your list? Impressive can be whatever you want it to be.
Well, I mean,
one that meant the most to you, perhaps.
I enjoyed the Kirtland's warbler, obviously just because it's cool. But there were so many. The McQueen's bustard.
Those are cool.
And we were up in Israel, and I hadn't seen, and it just was kind of a nemesis, so I felt good about that. There were a few easy birds that I felt annoyed that I hadn't gotten, that I got a reprieve, you know, due to the kind of the call from the governor to go to Africa. Mm-hmm. Typical, so like European bee eater and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
A bit of satisfaction because I had them and just wasn't able to get the photo taken, you know. So there's some of that as well. Others that will remain painful, just then some of the near misses too. That the turtle dove, European turtle dove, over there, came around a corner, and there's one just sitting there at the sewage pond in Yodvada.
Mm-hmm.
Behind there, it's just perfect light. Lights right behind me. It's on this dead snag at eye level. I'm like, oh man, look, there it is. Swung over the scope. And you've been there, so you know what I'm talking about. It's a desolate place.
It is.
And all of a sudden, this guy comes walking around the corner with like a mosquito dip net to do water quality, like right then.
Right in front of the turtle dove.
Like crashes through the trees right under the bird and it flies off. I'm like, man. Are you kidding me? What? How is that even? How'd that happen? But yeah. So some of the challenges.
Yeah. The idea that you not only see the bird, but also have to get the photo of it. That's gotta be like, is there that moment of stress between finding the bird and then, that moment where you're trying to, even as fast as you are trying to get the scope on it, trying to get your camera where it needs to be. Yep. And then, obviously sometimes that doesn't work out.
Towards the end, again, going with my manic sort of craziness, I found myself getting ugly with that too. I'd be so annoyed if I missed the shot. I was so mad at myself, and I don't want to be that way. I don't be that guy. But still, it's a world record. If anyone else were to actually go after this and say, hey, that's an interesting, and pretty low hanging fruit too. Mm-hmm. I mean, for the places I went, to go to Cali, Colombia and only get 130 species,
right.
As an example, if someone were going there properly on a birding trip rather than just taking advantage of what time they had, it would be a totally different world. I mean, they should come back with 300, 350 species maybe, on a trip like that. Africa, same way, we were mostly at the conference, which was fantastic, so inspiring. And then afterwards, we tried to fit in a 2.5 to 3 week itinerary is what they usually run in 7 days. It was like morning of birding, hop on the bus, go.
The birding there is really interesting too, because a lot of it is in those safari vehicles too, where you're popping up through the roof of the car. Yeah. How do you set up your scope in that situation?
And that was the thing. So I've learned a new trick. I got some bean bags because I got to thinking about that.
Oh, good call.
Bean bags, and I pile them up and like slam the scope down into it, make a little dent. And then the vehicle, you can't turn them off if there's elephants or lions going. So there's a lot of vibration. So I got a lot of less than totally crisp images there as a result. Mm-hmm. But I was surprised at how well I was able to do without a tripod.
Yeah.
Another little funny thing about that, it was coming to Costa Rica. We got laid over, missed our flight. We're supposed to have basically 3 full days and wound up just being just over 2 days to play. Mm-hmm. But they lost track of the luggage, like the tracking wasn't working. I said, well, it may or may not be coming. And I'm thinking, that's my tripod. It's in that check bag.
Yeah.
So when we first got there, we'd develop a plan that I was going to use my son as my tripod and it's going to like slap it over his shoulder.
I've done that actually. The first time I ever went to Costa Rica, this was a long time ago. One of the guys I was with, had one of those old Swaro, telescoping, travel tripods, scopes. He didn't have a tripod. So like whenever we found something good, you had kind of like kneel in front of him and he'd put it like right on your shoulder and look through the bird. We'd take turns. It was, you make do. You make do.
Necessity, you know.
Necessity. Mother of invention.
So there was always some fun challenges and I'm really looking forward to hopefully someone breaking this record and having more people even go after, because it was a fun way to do it, you know, and it wasn't, especially because the bar is so low, you know. When I first broke 1,000, I started asking, has anyone ever done more than this? And everyone just kind of laughed. I said, we've never counted, you know.
Right. Yeah, well, I mean, that's the way this stuff is. I mean, people had this idea of what a big year, capital B, capital Y, is.
Right. Yeah.
And everyone's been going after that for years. But now there's all these kind of new iterations on this theme. Dorian Anderson's bike big year, big year, 5 mile radius big year, county big year. So all that stuff. Yep. There's all these different ways to bird. And, you know, I think it's great that people are finding stuff that's meaningful to them and then going after it and, you know, setting a mark, that little piece of pride. But there's so many different ways to do it. And this is another one. So
yeah, well, there you go. So there it is. It's another category.
Yep.
Right for the plucking people.
That's right. Low hanging fruit.
Yeah. If you need tips on digiscoping and working on your speed, come see me at one of the festivals. I'll tell you everything I know. It takes seconds.
Yep. Jeff Boughton is from COA. He is the current holder of the Digiscoping World Big Year record, such that that is a record. And he invites you to take him up on breaking it. Go for it. What was your total? 1,050-ish.
Yeah. Like I said, I may, when I finish getting all the photos looked at, I may subtract two or three. I'll be able to do an update when I finally finish that endeavor, but it's time consuming. And as you know, I'm traveling a lot.
You're a busy man. Also. Yeah. where can people find your photos? They're on eBird, right?
Some on eBird. Yeah, for sure. I didn't get them all up there. And then of course, you know, on social media,
the socials, we'll link to them. Jeff, congratulations. Thanks so much for chatting about it.
Appreciate you, man. It's good talking to you.
The American Birding Podcast is brought to you by the American Birding Association. Don't forget to join the ABA. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll be eligible for a lot of great benefits, including our fantastic magazines, all our online stuff like the magazine archive, the new identification portal, discounts to partners like Olympus, OM Systems, BDO Books, Cornell Lab of Ornithology, and more. Special shout outs this week to Dave Bennett and family of Marilla, New York, Rachel Gordon and family of Wayne, New Jersey, John Rumney and the Rumneys of Cascade, Montana, and Laura Serdiak and the Serdiak family of Claremont, Florida. All of whom recently joined the ABA noted this podcast as a reason for doing so. Welcome to the ABA. Thank you so much. Executive director of the ABA and executive producer of the podcast is Wayne Klockner, who hits Las Vegas like a Carassius garrulus migrating over the Mediterranean. A high roller. Technical production is by John Lowry, who always places bets like he photographs waterfowl from the big blind position. Additional help comes from Maggie Fitzgibbon and Greg Neese, who always bet big on a full house of purple martins before the house sparrows find the gourd setup. You can find us online at aba.org, on social media, most everywhere as American Birding Association. On Blue Sky, we're at ABA Birds. Questions, comments can come to podcast@aba.org. I'm Nate Swick. Thanks for listening. Bird like Tom. See you next week.